Thank you for joining us for Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride, and we have some great conversations ahead of us today. For Indigenous people, everything in the natural world is interconnected. How that perspective is often missing in Western science. And the science behind dyeing mountain goat wool for Chilkat blankets. Some of the plants and materials that native weavers use might surprise you. And the art of preserving food, something the Cooperative Extension Service has down to a science. And in our forecast, clear skies tonight, but expect some patchy fog with freezing fog later on near downtown Juneau and Douglas, lows in the upper 20s. Patchy freezing fog in the morning, otherwise clear skies. Juneau Afternoon will be right back after National Native News. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Thank you for being here with us today. I'm Rhonda McBride. When Dr. Wendy Smythe was a small child, she was immersed in nature. She not only absorbed the beauty of Southeast Alaska, but the traditional ecological knowledge of her Haida people, knowledge that she still taps today as a scientist. And she is now a professor at the University of Minnesota Duluth and is this Friday's presenter in the University of Alaska Southeast Egan Lecture Series, and she joins us now. Well, welcome to our program. You know, it is so exciting to kind of get a preview of what your lecture will be about, but I think people will want to know a little bit about you, Wendy. Can you talk about your childhood experiences that led you to become a scientist?
Yes, absolutely. But can I introduce myself first in my language?
Please.
Hadalas at unthisonthi gudalelagen. Sanatlas stastis onai hatai udi ijum. Di hadas hatai hatagen. Gistakas gustudi qualagen. Di hlingwai klakia aigagen. Gist atloa hinodekeong. Wendy Smythe yatsai kith hinodekeong. Donna Douglas di au ijum. Alec Ruth Douglas di chin di nanu ijum. Hikta hundalai stuth ijum. Good people, I'm happy to be here with you today. Thank you for having me on. I'm Alaska Native Haida of the Eagle Moiety. I am Sanatlas Fishegg clan of the Sculpin Crest. I introduce myself as an observer of the world or an Indigenous scientist. And I do that with intentionality because oftentimes our students struggle with identity when they're going into academia. And so I introduced myself as both. I'm both a scientist and a Haida woman. My Haida name is Kstahlua, and my family is Donna Douglas, and my grandparents are Alec and Ruth, and my family is from Haidaberg.
Well, your introduction is really impressive, especially when you consider that Haida doesn't have that many fluent speakers. So how did you learn? Who taught you how to introduce yourself in your language?
We've had, so in Heidelberg, we have a nonprofit, Hadas Kilkwayas Foundation. So, and I've been learning Haida over the last, I think it's in and out of classes as I go into Heidelberg when I get to go home, taking classes from Kuyang or Binyang. And then in the last year and a half, I've been taking and hosting online Haida language classes for beginners. And so we've been, in spite of COVID, still reclaiming our languages in a virtual space for the last year and a half to 2 years. And that is all funded through our nonprofit.
So
that's focused on reclaiming language.
So you're immersed in culture even today, but as a little girl, it was something that you breathed into you, absorbed. How did that lead to you becoming a scientist?
It's funny. I remember, diving off the dock and trying to catch fish, and my chana, telling me to get out of the water. It's too cold. But I stayed in there catching fish and crawling through the forest and mushrooming and everything that we do when we're home. But when we're there, and that's how we grow up, it's just part of life. It's just part of who we are. And we don't see, we don't have to, we're not asked to see it in a different way. And then when I went away to college, that's when it started being pushed against of like, well, that's just traditional. That's just a story, or that's just, so this deficit language started getting attached to it. And I really struggled with identity of, am I Haida when I'm home and a scientist when I'm not? And so as I went through my journey, I just found a way to start. You have to be your whole self. You cannot be two people. So I just decided to merge these two worlds together and started seeing the beauty of seeing an environment and a space in two different ways, seeing the cultural part of it, and then seeing this Western construct of what science is, and tying them together enriches what we're doing, enriches the research, enriches what we're looking at. Knowing that history really changes how we interpret the science. I have a research site on Prince of Wales, and Miju, Claude Young told me, when you go out there, taste the water. And I go out there and I taste it. And when I say taste, I bring folks out there, taste it, don't drink it. There's a big difference between the two. Oftentimes I see people taking big swigs of it, and it's terrible tasting. It's full of metal. But what I've learned to do is every time I go out there, I do taste the water. And then I do that. We go down and sample and do the geochemistry along the system. And now when I taste the water, I know when there's going to be a high concentration of iron in that water and when it's going to be low, because it's sweeter at different parts of the year. And so he had told us that they called that sweet water, and it's just carbonated water with lots of iron in it. But now when I taste it, I know if we're going to have a high iron concentrations or low iron concentrations. And I think that's really, really cool to be able to do, to go out there and predict what we're going to find on based on what our elders told us to do when we go out there.
Well, their education was based on sharing knowledge about generations and generations of observation. And
absolutely.
You know, it seems to me that one of the pitfalls of modern science is the samples that they have in research, that it's a relatively small sample of data, but they draw big conclusions from that. And where traditional knowledge is as vast as the people's time on the planet.
Absolutely. And that's why it's really interesting to me to, and I want to make sure I tie these two worlds together, because when we go into academia and in these colonized Western spaces to learn about Western science, that is what we're learning, only Western science. There is no space for traditional knowledge systems that are thousands of years old, where Western science is hundreds of years old. And so I start my new thing I've been doing this last year and a half is challenging scientists of, do you know the history of place? Because the history of that space impacts your science. If you're finding an anomaly, why? What happened there? What people were there to impact that space? And again, we sustained, our people sustained for thousands of years in spite of impacts on, you know, weather patterns changing, the attempted ethnocide. You know, we sustained, and that was because we have proven science systems. We have proven science and we have proven knowledge, and it will continue to sustain us forever, because we're reclaiming it. And that's the beauty of now, is that we can reclaim this knowledge and teach our kids and not pay a price for it. Before, you know, there was danger in learning our knowledge systems and incorporating them. And we're in a time where that we haven't lived in a time like this before. And so it's really important, I think, to celebrate that and integrate it so that our kids know what they do, their daily life is based in science.
Based in reality, perhaps, because I think a lot of times absolutely. We live in our world of online information and not real contact with things. So what is your specialty, your area of research?
Depends on what day it is.
as I understand, you've got this added component of traditional knowledge being incorporated. But initially, when you went to college, what were you studying?
So I have a molecular microbiology background, and I have a PhD in earth and environmental science engineering, and I have a PhD in oceanography and coastal ecosystems. And I tie these two worlds together, looking at chemistry of water, how the geology impacts. So I did everything like holistic knowledge, which drove my advisors crazy because I had to see the whole system. I couldn't just look at one part of it. So I look at how geology impacts water chemistry, because rock dissolves in water, and how that water enriched in metals and carbon and other elements feeds microbial communities. So bacteria, and how those bacteria take that rock and turn it back into rock and recycle it into the environment. So it's a holistic closed loop system that I work in. That's my research part of it. And then I talk to elders and tie in the history, traditional knowledge component of it. But I also have a whole nother side of the research that I do, other than the geology, geoscience, and education. I also do some social science research, and I work with, over the last 6 years, I work with faculty across the country to teach them how to work with Indigenous communities in a respectful, ethical manner, that what tribal sovereignty is, how complicated tribal governments are, and that when you work with our communities, you know, drop your title and come in humble and come in to learn, really learn who we are. Because there's, if they're going to, you know, there's this extractive component to that. So trying to teach people not to do that. Our knowledge systems belong to us, and you have to get permission to use them. But also, permission doesn't mean permission till the end of time. You have to maintain a trusting relationship. So I do research on that side too, teaching scientists how to engage in these relationships in a respectful manner. I work with funding agencies too. And then we kind of gauge and see, are we able to shift these ideas of who we are? Because we know what mainstream society tells us who we are, and that's not who we are. We are so much more than what this country would lead us to believe through social media, TV, radio, and whatnot. And I do that also because I don't want students coming through this pathway experiencing the same things I did. And if I can change one mind and have them interact with a student in a positive way, it's worth it.
So in your lecture this coming Friday night, I love the title of it, The Science in Our Stories, Connection to Place, Belonging. So that hints at an interesting lecture.
I hope so. I'm gonna take one of our creation stories, and we're going to listen to it in Hodgkill. So we're going to listen to it in Haida. It's already pre-recorded. And then I'm going to translate it, and we're going to talk through different parts of science that are tied up in that story. And that story is hundreds of years old. And as it came around before some of the current, that story was developed before some of the current science, Western science. And so to look at that and deconstruct it and say, hey, this is proof we knew this. This is proof that we know that our knowledge systems contain important science. And we know that. I'm not trying to convince anyone of that. But what we have to continually do is show Western science that there's no hierarchy. Western science is not above traditional knowledge systems. That there's an equality to it. There's just different ways of looking at and interacting with the world. On one side, there's an understanding of the relationship we have with land, air, and water. And on the other side, everything is siloed and fragmented. And so we're going to talk about that and compare those knowledge systems and talk about how our stories contain geology, geography, chemistry, biology. It's all tied in there. And so it's a really fun story to deconstruct. And then I do this to make lessons plans for students, because when we ask them, do you know science? They often say no. And I'll say, do you know this story? And they know this story. And then we go back and say, okay, here are the parts of it. You are a scientist. You know this. Our people are scientists naturally. That's who we are. But we never, you know, they don't hear that acknowledgement in mainstream anywhere, right? We never hear that.
So one of the things that affects Alaska Natives is subsistence, because that is where you see traditional knowledge clash with Western science. And often their science, say, for example, might be based on an aerial survey. And maybe the weather is bad that day, and the count of the herd might not be that good. And yet, you know, the decision whether you hunt or don't hunt depends on that. Or you have Native elders and other hunters who have been on the grounds, they've seen the animals, and they say, well, you know, I don't think your numbers are right. I think it's okay for us to hunt. I mean, so really, is there an area for this traditional knowledge to get some acceptance and validation from game managers, fish managers, Western scientists?
Yes. So, and that you hit it, you hit the nail on the head. There's a difference between being connected to the land and space and just going over and doing an aerial survey, right? And doing a one time point. We have a much more rich knowledge system and engagement instead of just doing a one time point, one look. One of the things I do is try to teach that to state and federal employees and faculty of how to engage with our people to validate and know that we know what we're talking about, and we shouldn't have to do that, no doubt, but we do, and for them to listen. And I think we're finally getting to a space. It changes, right? The pendulum swings with every new administration that comes in. We've watched this play out over the last few years. And we have a chance right now to bring our knowledge to the forefront and for it to be acknowledged and accepted, because it's mandated. It's federally mandated. We have to do that, though, before it swings back the other way, because once that door swings shut, it will be bolted. It will be locked for a long time, because there's fear based in learning our knowledge systems. There's a loss of power, and there's a fear of power sharing. And so if my knowledge system, my Western knowledge system, is no longer the only one and valid, I'm going to be afraid, and I'm going to do whatever I can to strike out. So we have an opportunity now to really own our voice and speak up about our authentic experiences, because you cannot, the authentic voice is much more powerful than the presumed voice, right, of what you think is happening and what you know is happening. Does that make sense?
It does. And coming up, we're going to have a very interesting conversation with folks that have been studying the dyes used in Chilkat blankets. And, you know, everything from moss to urine to who knows what has been used to create these colors, you know, that we so admire. Blankets that are 100 years old. Mm-hmm. To me, that is almost a form of science, isn't it? To know how
Absolutely.
To take those yeah. those natural things from the world and turn them into dyes.
Yeah, it's chemistry. It's chemistry. Like I've talked to some artists about this, and they've talked about grinding up clamshells and using urine. There's a base and there's an acid. And so, yes, it's chemistry. It's chemistry. And when we look at also there's some, you know, we have a lot of iron rich places where you have a lot of the orange coloration. And then there's purple coloration. That is manganese and iron. And it's all based on chemistry, why it's there. So absolutely.
But I guess we don't really often appreciate that these early artists were experimenting. They were doing scientific experiments, basically. Let's put this together to see what happens with that. I mean, do you think that that's something that we need to appreciate is how these wonderful things were done?
Absolutely. And it would be, wouldn't you rather sit in a chemistry class that's teaching you how it was done instead of being talked at about hydrogen ions and protons? Wouldn't that be more exciting? Because when we talk to students, we already know when we talk about hydrogen ions and the chemical reactions, they start nodding off because there's no connection. So if we can take our knowledge systems and show, here's how they knew what was going to happen, or here's how they experimented, it's much more exciting. It's much more interesting, and it's valid. They can see that there is chemistry tied in there. And that's what I do. We take these different systems. We can teach chemistry also by talking about spruce roots. You have to have a certain pH to get the right type of root. If it's acidic, your root's going to fall apart and you won't be able to weave with it. Students know that. And when you start tying that science part into what they know and to our culture, you can see a light go off and they're so excited to do it now.
And, you know, I don't think it matters whether you're indigenous or from another culture. These kinds of bits of information are they make it real rather than just a bunch of numbers. And well, Wendy Smith, Dr. Wendy Smith, I want to thank you for being here with us. The Egan Fall Lecture Series is this Friday at 7. You can watch it online, as a matter of fact, and you can go to uas.alaska.edu/EganLecture, all one word, Egan Lecture, to find out about Dr. Smythe's lecture and some of the others. But thanks so much for being here with us. Any parting thoughts for us before we go?
I look forward to seeing you on Friday. Hawa dangath kalag, and thank you for having me.
And I will say hawa, right? Thank you and haida.
Yes.
All right. Gunash Chish from Tlingit country.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. We're getting closer and closer to saying goodbye to the Spirit Wraps Around You exhibit at the Alaska State Museum. It's only been here since May, but it does close this coming Saturday. So our hope is that after you hear from our next guest, you will want to head over there and soak in the beauty of the blankets, robes, and other weavings from Southeast Alaska Native culture. The exhibit was 30 years in the planning stages and features some of the oldest known ceremonial robes of Tsimshian, Haida, and Tlingit people. And among the weavings, you will find mountain goat wool, hand-spun into shades of seafoam green, springtime yellow designs outlined in midnight black. And one of the advantages of this exhibit has been a chance for weavers and scholars to learn more about this tradition. And one of the areas of exploration is what plants and natural materials did weavers use to produce all those beautiful colors. And joining us to share some of what was learned, Ellen Carley, she's conservator at the Alaska State Museum, and Lily Hope, a weaver and teacher, and they're all part of the Chilkat Dye Working Group exploring all of this. Well, first of all, I want to welcome both of you, and maybe you could begin. We'll start with you, Ellen, about some of your impressions about what this exhibit has meant to this tradition.
Well, I think one of the most important things about the exhibit is how collaborative it has been and how it has co-curators from Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian cultures. It was Lonnie Hotch, Marie Oldfield, and Evelyn Vanderhooper were the three co-curators and weavers who were part of developing that exhibit. And then Lily and I have been part of this large group of weavers and dyers who have been studying the materials. So I think that the collaboration has been one of the most exciting parts of the exhibit.
How about you, Lily? Because you inherited a lot of knowledge, you know, from your family, but did you expand what you knew during this exhibit?
I don't know if expansion is the word as much as reaffirmation, like the affirmative that this is where I'm supposed to be and the work that we are supposed to continue doing. I think that's what I got out of it. I was demonstrating at the museum a few days a week for most of the exhibition from May to October. There was a month there where I wasn't in, but being in the space with these ancestral weavings really has brought that affirmation.
And you also taught some classes on how to dye wool, and they were packed. They were filled up almost as soon as they were advertised. What was that like, sharing that knowledge?
Teaching is my heart work. That's my happy place. And teaching youth is especially more so. Teaching with Ellen is 10 times more fun. So it was a blast. We had quite a number of youth, gosh, 20-something youth, almost 30 youth come, and we dyed 7 different colors, trying on acrylic, cotton, and wool, and it was a great, great afternoon. Chilly, but quite fun.
So for people that don't know very much about weaving, maybe we should start with some basics. So Ellen, what is Chilkat dye, and how is it different than other dyes?
Well, there's only 3 colors that we usually see in the Chilkat weavings. We see a dark brown or a black, we see yellow, and then we see a blue or a green. And that goes back to the form line and how the designs are developed. But you would think only three colors, there wouldn't be that many choices. But it's been kind of astonishing to us how many different choices there really are for accomplishing those colors.
And so, Lily, how did you learn about dyeing wool?
Well, I started in my teen years with my mother, who was a renowned Chilkat weaver, Clarissa Rizal. She spent a lot of time dyeing with synthetic and acid dyes, commercial dyes. So I was stirring dye pots, you know, and listening to Van Morrison with her for 30 years now. But she didn't dye with natural yarns. I asked her about it. I said, can we dye with natural colors? Can I do this pale yellow? And she said, well, my teacher said, you know, do you want your yellow to be yellow in 500 years? And I said, well, I'm going to be long dead in 500 years. What do I care? I want to dye with the old materials. So I didn't get into the dyeing until this Chilkat Dye Working Group started with Ellen and the Alaska State Museum and Liana Wallace and all these other women. And it was about community for me. I really wanted to explore that with other people. That's teaching, collaborating with people. That's it. Drives me to it.
Well, we live in a disposable world, you know, where things are not meant to last 300 years. Ellen, have those colors pretty much kept their original intensity? There were some older blankets in the exhibit, more than 100 years old. Do you think that they faded much over time?
Well, some of them more than others. You know, the fronts of the robes, all of them are astonishingly gorgeous. But when you look at the backside, often the colors are more vivid on the backside. But it depends on the colorant. It depends on the dye. Some of them last longer than others. When we just mailed back the yarns to the kids that were part of the dye workshop just a couple weeks ago, we've encouraged them to do a little fading test, cover up some of the yarns with some tinfoil, hang it in the window for a couple of months and see which of the colors fade and which ones stay around. It's pretty interesting science.
Well, Lily, what about making something to last hundreds of years? That's pretty special.
You know, we think as parents that we're going to birth children and they'll be around for, you know, another 75. But yes, I agree with you. It's pretty special to weave something that will be here 5, 10, 20 generations from now.
And why was that important? Can you give us some of the culture behind these robes? Because many of them are sacred and spiritual.
Well, Chilkat dancing blankets have been our identity for Tlingit Haida Tsimshian peoples of the northwest coast of Alaska for hundreds of years. It captures our migration histories. We weave our clan identities, our clan crests onto them, sometimes dreams, sometimes political outgoings. My mother wove a robe called Resilience that had boats and school doors and logos from the corporations here in Southeast that have supported Native peoples since ANCSA. So they're vitally important as record-keeping documents. I call them our recorded history, our woven history.
They are so many things, from woven history to objects that bring ceremony and comfort and also are just beautiful to look at. We're trying to get people to go and see that exhibit because we know that they are going to regret it, especially if they look at the catalog that's been done later and they start looking at it and go, oh, I wish I had seen that in person, that beautiful blanket. So from your perspective, Lily, why should people go see that exhibit? You know, I know for you as a weaver, it must have been amazing to see this collection.
I would encourage people to go see this space because it's a chronological telling of how we came to be weaving Chilkat blankets. It starts in cedar bark and spruce root and goes into the raven's tail geometric, northern geometric weavings, and then transitionals as we bring in the form line from our bentwood boxes and our house screens up on the coast. And then these Chilkat dancing blankets that are really beings in themselves, a record not only of the clan, but of this weaver's life, of the family and community that supported this weaver in creating the work, which goes back to the dyeing and the spinning and the harvesting of cedar and the hunting of mountain goats, the pattern development. It was a community affair.
You know, we were talking about how these were made to last hundreds of years, and we have this disposable society today where things are made on machines and very quickly. Can you give us an appreciation of how much time it took to make some of the robes and blankets that are on display?
Thousands of hours. 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 hours for each one. If you're talking raven's tail, a little geometric, they get to weave from the left side to right side and make progress all the way. Some of them still take 800 to 1,500 hours to make. Sometimes two or three weavers working together, but that doesn't count the 6 to 15 weeks of preparations of gathering bark and hunting goat or splitting merino wool and cooking cedar bark so it's not sappy. I mean, all the preparations that go into it, thousands and thousands of hours. If a Chilkat blanket maker weaves 5 blankets in her life, she's hit the 10,000 hours of mastery that Malcolm Gladwell talks about. And imagine 24 of these in one space and how many lifetimes that is, how many hours and hours of weavers and hearts and hands in the work. I've heard that many people who have visited the exhibition cry when they enter just from the sheer overwhelm of like, this is history for a moment in time and how many hearts went into the work, not just the weavings, but the curation of the exhibit.
So, Ellen, what is your takeaway from the exhibit, the thing that is the must-see?
I can't even, I mean, it's not, as the previous speaker was talking about, like you, it's not possible to just divide it up and say there's one thing in there because it's the whole experience of all these robes together with each other in that space that makes, I mean, just talking about it, the hair is standing up on my arms, and we've been working on this for years. It's all of it coming together in that way.
Well, what about the part of the exhibit, you know, which you've been involved with that talks about the different dyes?
Well, of course, we're bonkers about that nerdy part of the exhibit. There's 4 cases right underneath a lovely taxidermied mountain goat on loan to us from the Mercantile Armory here in town. But there's 4 cases, one for each of the 4 colors. And they're loaded with yarns and plant materials and dye baths and all these things that we've been working on for the past several years in this kind of long-term relationship with the weavers and some chemists down in Portland State University. Tammy Lassiter-Claire is the chemist that's working on analyzing a reference set of dyes that the weavers have been working on for years, coming up with all these plants from the land and dyes that can be made from them. And then that chemistry lab is also, with tiny samples, just a couple eyelashes worth, looking at all the dyes in the robes that the Alaska State Museum cares for. So that those cases that kind of talk about this process of our research together is, of course, very exciting to those of us in the Chilkat Dye Working Group.
Well, tell us a little bit about the working group. I mean, who are your members? Can anybody join?
So I think part of the success of that group is that it was the vision of Lyanna Wallace, who's a Tlingit culture bearer and weaver. And it was her who said, wouldn't it be cool? You've got that conservation lab. We should study dyes. And so when these chemists in Portland had a grant, Lyanna and I pitched this project. And she was the one who decided who the first few folks were to come on board and start to build the trust between the museum and the weavers. And it sort of has grown from there. And there's about 30 people there. That are on the, there's a email group, but people get at it every couple months and it's kind of word of mouth. And there's also only about a dozen people who are super active who have turned in samples and whatnot. And I think that the community, a lot of weavers in the community are still looking to see what we do with the information, to see if we're trustworthy, to see what comes out of it. And so I think it's going to go on for a while yet, this research project.
Lily, how do you feel about being part of this group? Do you think there's a lot of potential to revitalize weaving through this group?
I've seen that people are excited about the dye itself and figuring out which yellows particularly stay the longest with light exposure. That's been really great. I don't know if it's helping revitalize the weaving, but it is definitely waking up the scientists in all of us. And even the weavers who are in the group that we are now going back to, like, oh, we don't have to use acid dyed yarns. We can actually use these colors that don't fade. So motivating us to continue the work with the old traditions, right? Using the dyes that are 300-year-old practices. So yeah, I'm excited about that. There's a way forward with the old knowledge.
But one of the parts of the exhibit that captivated me was a Hershey bar wrapper, a brown wrapper. And apparently women used it, boiled it to get a brown dye. So nothing stays exactly traditional, should it? You know, should we say, oh, we can't have other colors and other things. We should just stick to the traditional materials.
Well, my sister, Ursula Hudson, she goes by Kadu Sne, that's her Tlingit name. She has made it really clear that innovation has always been traditional, that we've been resourceful. Yes, all the things that we need are in our backyards. But then when a Hershey bar crosses our way or a marine trade blanket comes our way and we can leach the blue dye out of this wool blanket, we're going to do it because we can. Because it's available to us. And, you know, our potatoes are 10,000 years old from Peru. So we've been trading for thousands of years. And if we can dye with chocolate wrappers, we're going to. It's all the sweeter.
I like that. All the sweeter. Well, Ellen, before we go, any words about how to access the exhibit in these final days?
Yes. So the museum's open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 4. And of course, this Saturday, October 9th, is our last day, sadly. The catalog is available if you come to the museum, but it's also available at the Friends of the State Library Archives and Museum website. That's foslam.org. And our dye research and a lot of the exhibit is available on the museum's website at museums.alaska.gov.
So I guess it is goodbye, but hopefully we'll have a way to stay in touch with this beautiful art. I want to thank you very much, Ellen Carley from the Alaska State Museum, and Lily Hope, a teacher and a weaver and much, much more, a person with a lot of passion for sharing this art. Thank you so much for being here with us. Gunash Chish.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Well, we have certainly been talking about art and science today on our program. I'm Rhonda McBride, and I'd like to have that conversation continue because food preservation is definitely an art as well as a science, and the Southeast Alaska Cooperative Extension Service is probably one of the best resources in our region for that. And this fall, they have another program out that will cover a lot of ground. Food preservation, taught by Sarah Lewis, from her home to your home for the next 8 weeks, all taught online. And joining us now to tell us about that and some of the other programs is Sarah Lewis, who is the Southeast Alaska Extension agent. I know that you've probably been getting questions all summer from people about, when is your class coming? When is your class coming?
Yes, I have. Thank you so much for having me on. And I actually just have to comment, following on such amazing guests, one thing that I loved was that, yeah, we are a group of folks who are nerdy about the chemistry of our work. And I'm no exception to that. So we like to, you know, the scientists in all of us, as Lily mentioned. So, yeah, so I get lots of questions about food preservation all through the summer, and ready to start into some fall and winter and spring classes.
Well, I guess your first class gets started tonight. So is it a little bit too late to get involved in that?
It actually isn't. I chose the class for tonight quite specifically that it doesn't require much preparation on the part of the participants. So they can just sign on and join, whereas a lot of the other classes in the series, if people wanted to cook with me, you know, and want to be prepared for doing that while I'm cooking live, a little bit of preparation is needed for those. But even frankly, for those, if you just wanted to sit back and have your dinner while you watch me make something and teach the basics of food preservation, from water bath canning to pressure canning, dehydrating, pickling, we'll be doing all of those.
So how is that working for people? What kind of feedback are you getting when they cook along with you in their own home?
So I get the whole range. There are folks who love to cook along with, and they'll actually keep their camera on while we're cooking together. And there are folks who do just watch and take notes, and then they cook later. And then on this particular series, I'm also going to be recording them. That's never guaranteed. So that's something I always like to tell people, you know, technology is technology and we do our very best. But so I'm going to be recording them. So if there's some reason why you can't make it, they will be available for a week afterwards. So the week following the class, the recording will be available. But really what's happened is by going online, and of course we were forced to go online about 18 months ago, but it was something we were slowly trying to do anyways, because we knew that there was going to be folks who were going to love online, just like there are folks who love the in-person classes. And I've heard people say, no, I'm just not going to join the online classes. I'm going to wait until you do them in person again. There are folks who tell me, you know, I wouldn't have time to do this unless I was just sitting in my own kitchen and able to use my own equipment. And it really, it's like a time when I have it on my calendar to get some canning done, and I get it done with a, you know, a community of other canners. So we've broadened the number of people who have been included in our classes since we've gone online. And so we're going to keep doing both.
So are you getting to see other people's kitchens as you're teaching this workshop? And do they stop you and say, well, this is my pan for this. Is this a good one for that?
They do, absolutely, absolutely. And so if people choose to turn on their camera, they're not required to, but if they choose to, and to show me, yes, this is the kind of canner I have, or this is the condition my vegetables are in right now, tell me if this is going to be okay, how should I deal with these? That's been super fun. And then other people just have questions they put in chat. One of the great things about Zoom is there's lots of different personality types, and they all get to kind of join in some way or another, whether they like to be seen or whether they like to just type things in. It's been pretty awesome.
So go through what each course will be during this 8 weeks.
Sure. Yeah. They'll start at 5:30 on Tuesday. And you will be entering my kitchen, basically. And the first one is creating a food secure pantry. And so that is going to be a little bit more talking, less cooking, just to kind of talk about how to prepare your pantry for small or large emergencies. But then from October 12th through the 23rd, they're going to be actively canning classes or dehydrating classes or whatever the topic is. And so there'll be a little bit of, you know, quote unquote lecture time when I talk about some of the science and the important parts about the food safety. But then I'll be going through recipes and people will have access to an online web page for each one of the classes where the resources are, so they can open up the publications that are related, a list of things that they can have available and the recipes that I'm going to be doing in class if they want to follow along. And then we're just going to do that for an hour and a half. And if some of the canning takes longer than an hour and a half, so I'll be sort of really speeding through some things, or I'll have some things ready already, stuff like that. And so I plan to like have my email open for the rest of the evening in case people have started canning and they have questions, and they can email me for the rest of the evening on some of those questions in real time, which sometimes come up.
So by the end of this workshop, you expect that your participants will have quite a bit of food put away for the winter.
And I will too, actually. That's part of the beauty of being able to do it in my own home. I'm doing real recipes in jars that are the right size for my family. Whereas when I do them in person, we often do little tiny jars so everybody can get a sample of stuff. And that's great, too. So so it is pretty fun. If you were to take the whole, you know, all 8 classes, you'd have some jars put away. You'd have some dehydrated food. You'd have some sourdough starter in the refrigerator, things like that.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. You're making me hungry talking about all those things. One thing I did want to ask you about before we go is that you've got another workshop coming up. It was going to launch soon, but it's been pushed back. A wellness workshop to help people with chronic diseases or conditions make better choices.
Yeah. So Living Well Southeast Alaska, it's actually sort of a nationwide program, but we do it, there's several places here in Alaska that do it. And it's called a chronic disease self-management program. So it's a 6-week program that focuses on folks who have been diagnosed with diabetes or heart disease or depression or anxiety or any chronic ongoing condition. And through the program, we talk about, you know, coping skills, eating, how to talk to your doctor, how to keep up to date with your medications and how to remind yourself. And if there are any, as we're going, if the participants have any specific issues that they're having, we do a little bit of troubleshooting as a group and stuff like that. And so we're going to be starting that up in January. I'm speaking off the top of my head. I think January 10th might be the first day, but it's going to be Mondays, I believe from 5. It'll be Mondays starting in January. I'll have a flyer out pretty soon on that. And it's a great way to actually start the new year with, you know, focus on health. That's a time when a lot of people do focus on health is in the new year. So that's going to be a program I'll have available.
So do you expect that there'll be some sharing amongst the participants who might offer some of their solutions for how they approach
Absolutely.
Their doctors? And I mean, that could be very valuable, too, because say, for example, if you're a diabetic, a lot of times people have doctors that aren't diabetics and really don't know personally
exactly.
how these medicines affect people.
Right. That's exactly right. And so that's what's wonderful about the group setting of those. Is that there is that connection between people who have either similar medical conditions or similar circumstances. They've had similar experiences with the medical profession or with, you know, eating habits and healthy living lifestyle stuff.
Well, Sarah, before we go here, any quick reminders for people?
Sure. So you can find out about these classes at UAF, as in Fairbanks, uaf.edu/CES, as in Cooperative Extension Service. So uaf.edu/CES, you can find a calendar of classes throughout the state, most of them right now online, from gardening to health to food, and you can register through there. Or you can give me a call, 523-3280.
All right, we are out of time, but we want to thank you very much, Sarah Lewis with the Cooperative Extension Service. And that will do it for Juno Afternoon. Thank you so much for being here with us. Have a great evening.